Well, as part of our scripture reading this morning in Mark chapter 2, verse 27, Jesus says to the Jews there that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. You don't have to agree with this, but it is my understanding that Jesus is laying down a principle that is applied far beyond the context in which he is using it. Jesus is talking there about these disciples picking grains of wheat and rubbing them between their hands, which, according to the Sabbath laws that the Jews imposed upon their people, that was illegal. It was not illegal according to God's law, but their law was made up as par to God's law. They brought it up to that level. And that's really what Jesus is getting at here. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was a gift to man. Man was not to be imprisoned by the Sabbath. The original intent for the Sabbath was to rest from one's labors during the week and also to joyfully recount his deliverance by God from Egypt. And yet the Pharisees had turned the Sabbath into a legal institution. It wasn't something to honor. It wasn't something to celebrate. It was just another law to keep. In fact, they surrounded it with a hedge of laws, 39 of their own laws and ordinances and clinical observations, 39 of these stipulations in which to keep the Sabbath properly and legally. God gave the Sabbath to serve the people, but the Pharisees turned it into the people serving the Sabbath. And Jesus says, in essence, that is backward. You don't have it right. What does this have to do with marriage? Well, sometimes there are some in the brotherhood who offer a scientific and clinical analysis of what a scriptural marriage is or what it is not, and focus far less on the blessing of marriage and the benefit of marriage and the positive aspects of marriage. Specifically, that marriage is a sign or a symbol or a foreshadow of an ever-deepening fellowship with God. You don't focus on that as much. God didn't give us marriage just so that we could uphold the institution of marriage. That's not why he gave that to us. He didn't give it to us to imprison us. Marriage is a God-given gift that was meant to provide for our spiritual welfare, not to burden us and not to shackle us, rather, with a legal imprisonment. Marriage was made for people. People were not made for marriage, as if to uphold simply an abstract institution or an idea. And sometimes there are some, and they mean well, but they are so bent on upholding the institution of marriage that they forget that there are people in that institution. And we cannot lose sight of the original intention. God gave us marriage not to be obsessed with rules and regulations and technical details, but to prepare us for life with him in the hereafter and to guide us through the life that we have in the here and now. Now, with that said, the Pharisees, you know, would also rescue an animal on the Sabbath, and yet they frowned on the healing of an afflicted person, someone who had some disease or ailment, especially if they had endured that for some time. They gave adherence to the sign regardless of the suffering and the hardships on individual people. In other accounts, we could turn to that. But Jesus there in those places says, in essence, that you are a bunch of callous and merciless people when you do that. The Sabbath was not made just so that it could be observed. And you're going to observe it no matter what. Even if you're suffering, you should observe the Sabbath. That's not really what it was given for. Jesus condemns the merciless attitude of those people. You can't allow the sign to be more important than the people to whom the sign is given. You can't allow the sign to rise up to such a level that it becomes, in a sense, more important than the people whom God created and whom he gave the sign to. In other words, without concern for those people. And sometimes you hear people say something along the lines of, people have to stay married no matter what. And I've heard this myself over a number of years. They just have to stay married no matter what. That sends the wrong message. That sends the wrong focus. And that really focuses on the wrong objective. It's not about the marriage itself that we're upholding at any cost. That's not really what we're after. What we're after is getting people to understand how marriage is a gift and how they are to respond to that gift and how they are to use that gift for the betterment of themselves. And so it is in debates on marriage sometimes when you hear about a scriptural marriage. And I've seen some of these debates. I've heard them. I've got books in my office, transcripts of these very complicated debates where they're going into the very fine nuances of Greek words and terminology and everything else. And it seems like in those kinds of things, we're sidestepping the importance of what marriage is, and we're focusing only on the forensic details of, you know, the definitions of marriage. And I realize that marriage has to be defined, and God defines it. But I also understand that people are involved in marriage, and we cannot be inconsiderate to that fact. You can't keep the institution alive regardless of people. Imagine someone lying in a coma on a bed. And we're not just talking about a coma where there's hope for them to wake up from. We're talking about someone in a vegetative state where there is zero brain activity, and they're lying on a bed, and the only thing keeping them alive is a breathing machine and a feeding tube. And the family's all wringing their hands and wringing their hands and wondering, what should we do? Should we pull the plug or not? The thing is, pulling the plug isn't going to change what has happened here. The person is dead. Pulling the plug doesn't change that. It just finalizes, if you will, the artificial means that are used to sustain this once living person. That once living body is irreparably dead. What I'm talking about here is how some marriages are. Some marriages are just dead. One or both parties in that marriage are absolutely, adamantly refusing to do what they promised to do when they got married. They will not uphold the covenant. They will not listen to God. They will not do their part, or they have abandoned it, literally walked away from it completely. That marriage is dead. And yet sometimes what we do in our earnestness and in our good intentions is we go back to the other person who was just abandoned or who is trying to do their part, and we say, you need to keep this marriage alive no matter what. You have to realize that that marriage is dead. You can't be married by yourself. One person cannot be married. Marriage, by definition, takes two people. And we don't always want to admit that, because it sounds like what we're saying is we're just going to pull the plug on a living marriage, and that's not what's happening. Malachi chapter 2, verse 16, it is very clear, and we will cover this next week especially. God hates divorce. But he also hates dead marriages that are kept alive by nothing more than a piece of paper. In other words, an artificial means. A breathing machine and a feeding tube is really all that piece of paper is in that case. That's an insult toward the gift. That is a terrible misrepresentation of what he expects, and especially from Christians. But we must be very careful then not to be obsessed with the institution of marriage and we forget that people are in marriage. It means that we cannot be passive or unconcerned when we hear of someone's marital problems, but we say something like, well, as long as they don't divorce. What we're really saying there is, it's okay that you're having problems, even if they're catastrophic problems, and it's okay if someone, you know, does this or does that. We can live with all that, but as long as they don't ruin the institution. And what we're doing is we're raising the institution up higher than the people themselves. What we should be focusing in on is teaching those people how to use that institution and live within that institution in a God-given way. And hold them accountable to that, yes. But we can't put more emphasis on the institution itself than on the welfare of those for whom the institution was intended. Someone comes back and says, you are advocating divorce then. I would never advocate divorce. And those of you who know me and have heard me say anything on marriage or divorce in the past, you know my stand, and it is very strong. God upholds marriage, and he hates divorce. I would never advocate divorce. On the other hand, acknowledging that a marriage is dead is not advocating divorce. Acknowledging that a body is dead is not the same as killing the body. And you've got to understand that there's a difference between those two positions. I am not responsible if I tell someone that, hey, your husband has left you, has abandoned you, has no intention of coming back to the marriage, but you're still married and you'll be married for the rest of your life, and you're just going to have to learn how to deal with that. Because marriage is so sacred and is an institution that must be upheld at all costs. I would say to that person, there is no marriage. All you've got left is a piece of paper, right? A certificate, and that's it. A breathing tube, or a breathing machine rather than a feeding tube. That's all you've got. It's an artificial means at that point. You have to be realistic. A one-sided marriage is impossible to keep alive. And the fact is, you can't fan cold ashes and expect to get fire. There comes a point when the relationship is simply dead. There's nothing else that you can do for that. In the New Testament, the Jews kept the temple, so to speak, alive through the temple machinations there, offering sacrifices, priests doing their thing. But they were a spiritually dead people, impenitent, unwilling to change, unwilling to budge. Jesus condemned them outright. And God's response to that, even though they kept the institution alive, God's response to that was to put an end to the temple. I want you to think that there is a parallel to what is going on there. If indeed there is truly no relationship left, then keeping the institution alive is pointless and useless. That marriage, in that case, is dead. Now, and I want to be very clear on this, what we are not talking about here is simply an unhappy situation. I'm not talking about someone coming up to you and saying, I'm unhappy in my marriage, and you say, well, then your marriage is dead. Oh, no. Far from it. Happiness, as well as unhappiness, is a state of mind. And is a state of mind in either case that can be changed. And with the case of an unhappy person, it can be reversed. It can be overcome. So when someone comes to me and says, in essence, I'm unhappy with my marriage, my first response is, then you need to learn how to become content in God, first of all. That's really where the source of your problem is. Everyone has an unhappy time in their marriage. That just happens. And there's no one who is exempt from that. That's part of dealing with human beings in close quarters. Okay? You're going to have unhappy periods. And those periods may last an evening, it may last a day, it may last a week, it may last a month, it may go on for a couple of years. But everyone goes through those periods of so-called unhappiness. Your own spouse, I know this might sound surprising, but your own spouse will disappoint you at some time. Your spouse will let you down. Your spouse will act selfishly. Your spouse will, yes, sin against you. No marriage is exempt from that. No marriage is immune to that, even among Christians. So we're not talking about unhappy situations. Really, what I was talking about when I talked about dead marriages, I'm talking about extreme situations. We're not talking about situations where the marriage can recover and actually be better than it was before. We're talking about situations where one or both parties simply say, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I am out of here. I will not do what God says to do. There is nothing that you can do with that. That's a dead marriage. Unhappy marriages can be fixed, and most certainly should be. And we can resolve that situation. That person, I should say, can resolve that. So what the Bible does not teach is stay married unless you're unhappy. Then you're free to divorce because God doesn't want people to be unhappy. I don't know how many times I've heard that communicated to me over the years. God doesn't want me to be unhappy. And so therefore, that's why I'm choosing to go this route. What the Bible does teach, in essence, is learn how to find contentment in Christ and do your best to demonstrate that contentment in your relationship with your husband or wife. That's what it does teach. And that's a very different thing than simply saying, well, I'm unhappy. And so therefore, you know, God doesn't want us to be unhappy. I've yet to find a scripture where it says that, by the way. But God apparently doesn't want us unhappy, and therefore I'm unhappy, and this is where it's going. Look at Romans chapter 12 with me for a minute. Romans chapter 12, verse 16. And you look at this and you say, this doesn't have anything to do with marriage. I think it has everything to do with marriage because you're talking about two people working together in essence and two people's attitudes toward each other. In verse 16, we could actually go through more of this, but look at verse 16. Be of the same mind toward one another, husbands and wives. I'll interject here just to make sense of why I'm using this passage. Do not be haughty in mind, husbands or wives. Do not be wise in your own estimation, husbands or wives, in dealing with your husband or wife. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone, including your spouse. Respect what is right in the sight of all men, especially when dealing with your spouse. And if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with your spouse. Now you say, well, it doesn't say that exactly. Well, but it's applicable, isn't it? Because he's talking about Christians. And if we're talking about two Christians married together, then this is applicable. And this is certainly the attitude we ought to have. And if we are to say that this is the attitude we are to have with two people who are not married, how much more so should we expect it between two people who are? That's the point I'm trying to make here. These are the kind of attitudes both spouses ought to have toward each other. So when a person starts dwelling on his or her unhappiness, they often gravitate toward separation. They gravitate toward ending the relationship rather than seeking biblical and life-changing solutions. And the reason for that is usually pretty simple. Left to itself, human nature takes the path of least resistance. In other words, it's just easier. It's easier to end the relationship and chalk it up as experience rather than to buckle down and find out what God says to do and start working toward that objective together. That's the hard part, and yet that is the noble thing to do. That's exactly what God wants us to do. So we're not saying stay married no matter what. What we are saying is learn how mature and spiritual-minded people cope with the struggles of two people living in the same house in close quarters together. Okay? How they cope with that. Learn from those people. Seek out their advice and put that into action. We're not saying if your marriage seems dead, it's okay to divorce. We're not saying that at all. I'm certainly not saying that. But what we are saying is learn what God intended for your marriage to be and do something about that. Put that information, put that education, put that instruction into practice. And see what you can do through that effort to change at least your situation. Can't change your spouse. But you might have a great positive influence on that spouse if indeed you act like a Christian in your marriage. Having said all that, why did God give us marriage of all things? Why don't we just go out and do what we want to do, right? Procreate when we want to and have children kind of randomly bouncing between, you know, people and homes and so on. Why can't we just do that and not have to have this thing called marriage? Marriage is a type of a sign from God. Not all people have to marry, but it is a foreshadow of what is to come. In essence, it's a sign of a heavenly union with Christ. It's not the literal substance of that union because it's a sign. And when we're talking about a sign, we're talking not about the substance, but something that points to that substance. I've used the illustration before. When I'm driving into Seattle on I-5 and the sign says, "Welcome to Seattle," I don't camp there at the sign and say, "Well, here I am. I'm in Seattle." The city is beyond the sign. The sign simply points to the city and the fact that you have arrived or are near to arrive that city. It's a sign. And that's what marriage really is. It's not the thing itself. It's what it points to. This marriage that we're engaged in here, no pun intended, right? That we're participating in something that points to something greater than what we're doing here. But before we get into that, there's some practical reasons that make sense and appeals to our humanity, dealing with our earthly needs and our earthly circumstances. And you have them there in your outline. I'll just go through these briefly because they're pretty straightforward. First of all, stability. We need to, in order to provide for a functional society, it has to have a foundation, and marriage serves as the core foundational unit of every society. Makes it functional, it makes it a permanent social unit upon which society itself is built. It gives structure and consistency to any organized society. Every society in history has been based upon the same thing, on marriage. When you start undermining the definition of or the institution of marriage and hope to have a stable, functional society after that, you're asking for big trouble. You are basically saying that we are consenting to the decline of our society. I'll just let you read between the lines on that one, but look around you in society right now and see what is happening. All groups of human beings need leadership, they need organization, and they need binding commitments to keep them in that organization, to make that organization functional. And that's a key word that you keep hearing me talk about in regard to marriage, is functionality, or if you want, functionableness. I know that sounds awkward, but that's really what we're talking about, okay? Marriage vows are a solemn pact between two people to honor, first of all, that which binds them together, the pact itself. Secondly, those two people who are in that pact. That would mean the marriage, or the married people, the husband and the wife. And then thirdly, the one who made that pact possible, and that would be God. So the pact is honored, the solemnity of the pact, the sacredness of that pact. The people are honored, if you will, and God himself is honored. Not necessarily all on that same level, but they're all honored in that pact. Without that pact, people have no sense of responsibility or commitment or moral obligation. If everyone was unmarried, then we'd really be no different than animals fighting for survival with nothing to bind us together. Two people having a child together does not make a marriage. Parentage or parenting does not create necessarily this commitment pact. It just says that they have something in common. Marriage also provides a permanent companion throughout life. Of course, one's permanent welfare or personal welfare is considered there. Help when a person is sick or in trouble, provides food, income, etc. The things that people need for each other. Physical people need someone to love. They need to be loved. They need physical human contact, which is fellowship. Marriage provides a proper outlet for physical desires. Sexual desires, if you want, but in a more general sense, physical desires. Paul does address this here in 1 Corinthians 7:2. He says, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. In other words, in order for there to be a proper outlet or a proper context for how two people conduct themselves in that physical or sexual way, there needs to be propriety. It is a sin for people to engage in that activity outside of this marriage union. And so what God is saying, in essence, is I've given you a place in which you can do these things that is completely legitimate, it is completely holy, it is completely proper, and I look down upon that with favor. I do not look down upon that with favor of those outside of that, because that's not what you were created for. And that's not what the gift is for. It is an insult to the gift to look at this differently than how God looks at it. Sex is a privilege of marriage. It is not a recreational pursuit like our society thinks that it is. All sexual activity outside of a legitimate marriage relationship is called fornication, and all fornication is sin. What God is saying, in essence, is I don't want you to sin, even though you have these physical or sexual urges and desires, things that I built into each one of you, but I don't want you to sin in that, and so I've given you marriage as a proper outlet for that. It's a gift in that sense as well. It is an opportunity and an environment in which procreation can be done in a proper context, a functional, stable context. This forces and nurtures responsibility and accountability to people's children. The husband and the wife take on now the role of father and mother. Otherwise, there's no one caring for these children in the way they need to be cared for. And that threatens their survival, which threatens the future of that society. Not only that, but there is teaching that can be communicated from the father and the mother to these children on a regular and healthy basis. All kinds of things that we could look at here and pursue if we needed to. It also pursues, or pools, resources of the spouses, establishes hereditary rights, and of course, property and so on. What we're really talking about here is just legal claims and advantages. Marriage provides for that, as opposed to chaos and individual wealth. So these are some practical, physical-based ideas of why God has given us marriage. These appeal to our physical needs, they appeal to our physical survival, and they also appeal to our healthy physical existence. Those are good things. And we need these things. And any society that's going to be a society needs the core relationships to be built upon these very things. Now, some deeper and spiritual lessons here, and again, for time's sake, we're only going to go through these briefly, but these do teach us how better to understand and mature in our relationship in Christ. Now, someone says, but I'm not married and I don't plan on being married. Okay, you don't have to be married in order to understand better what's going on. I do think, and this is just my opinion, I do think that you need to participate in this to some extent, of course, right, to understand it more fully, but even an observer can see what's going on here. There is a foreshadow or a sign of this sacred union between Christ and his church. Christ and his church are in essence one, not two separate things, but one, just like the head and the body concept, right? Your head and your body are one unit. Even though you might identify them separately, they only function together. So let's turn over to Ephesians here, chapter 5, and see what Paul does say about that. Ephesians chapter 5. And stay there for a minute, because we've got a couple other things we'll be looking at in this chapter. Verse 23 and 24, the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. If the husband and the wife will not submit or give or sacrifice or respect each other on a physical level, how in the world are they prepared to respect Christ on a spiritual level? It's kind of like what John argues in 1 John chapter 4. If you can't love your brother whom you have seen, how in the world can you love God who you haven't seen? So if we can't function together on a physical, earthly context, how in the world are we prepared to deal with our spiritual relationship with Christ? All we're doing is admitting that we're immature people and that we're just not prepared for that. However, couples that imitate Christ and his church, and that union is really what I'm getting at, imitate that union, can do these things and can better understand and appreciate, yes, and enjoy that union that they have together. Marriage is not something that we have chosen to use as an illustration of Christ and the church. It is something Christ has given to us to define his relationship with his church. What I want to give to you here, and again, take this or leave it, but God had in his mind from the beginning this sacred, holy union between his son and the church. And he patterned earthly marriage after that, rather than saying, oh, the earthly marriage thing worked out so well, I think we'll use that for Christ and his church. No, the heavenly is the reality. It is the substance. What we see here on earth is the shadow and the sign. But if we fail to appreciate the sign, then we will not appreciate the substance. It allows intimacy, which cannot be reached by a mere physical level. In Ephesians 5, verse 31 and 32, this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, he says, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Obviously, the union between Christ and the church is not a sexual one. I think it would be blasphemy to even consider that. However, there is a sacred union there. There is a holy bond there that supersedes or transcends anything physical, earthly, or sexual. And so when two people come together as husband and wife, there are certain physical privileges that they have in that union, but the union that they really have is much higher and greater and more profound than that. That's what we're getting at, is that oneness, that unity, that ultimate fellowship that those two people are supposed to have. Anyone can be married technically. Anybody can share a bed. Anybody can have children. Anybody can grow old together. But a complete surrender to one's own flesh, that allows for this appreciation for this inseparable union of ourselves with Christ, with remarkable depth and understanding. And as we enjoy this uninhibited intimacy with our spouses, so we enjoy more so the self-disclosure that we have with Christ. When we get into a lesson later on communication, we're going to talk about self-disclosure. And it basically means that how far you open yourself up to somebody, okay? Acquaintances, we have a very minimal channel of information and things that are shared. With our spouses, right, it's a lot of information. With God, we stand completely before him, completely open to him. And so we'll be talking about that. And it helps us to understand that intimate self-disclosure that we have with Christ. We're not just related to Christ, like we're related to our husbands or wives, but our soul unites completely with His, so that the two are not two, but actually one. You say, that doesn't sound right, but 1 Corinthians 6:17 says, the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with Him. We're certainly looking at this on a spiritual level, but we are looking at this nonetheless. And the language that is used there is very similar to how a husband and a wife are joined together. They become one flesh. They become one. And here we're saying that our spirit with God's spirit becomes one in essence. Marriage also allows two people to work out their problems and to celebrate their successes. There's a cooperative arrangement here. Life can be exasperating and overwhelming on one's own. And most of us need to share that burden with someone else or have someone else, take part of that burden with us and so on, and as well as sharing in one another's victories and celebrations. There's mutual gratification, mutual support, mutual encouragement. There's this passage that I, when doing lessons on this, I like to cite this from Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9 through 12, where the writer there says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the other will lift up his companion. Woe to the one who falls when there's not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if two can overpower him who is alone, one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him, a cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. We'd like you to think of a husband and a wife and Christ as being those three strands that are tied together. A husband and a wife who have a mutual respect and love for Christ. And in essence, Christ is in the middle of their relationship. What binds them together is not just a marriage certificate, and it's not just an institution anymore. It is Christ Himself who binds them together. And then Peter says something about husbands and wives as being fellow heirs of life. And then you start to recognize that this marriage thing that probably began in a rather immature and physical and, you know, emotional way, over time it becomes more spiritual in nature. And we start to recognize that, my wife is not just a member of my family and not just a member of this church. She is a fellow heir of God with me. And that makes that so much more important than our union together. So it should be. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way God had intended that. Marriage is a sign of that ultimate fulfillment that we have with God. For right now, we appreciate our soulmate. We appreciate our lifelong partner. But all of this points forward to our life with God, not our life with our wife or husband for eternity, but our life with God. And hopefully they, in their life with God, will be there with us for eternity as well. It's a sign. And not the substance. We were never made to be separated from God. We were created for the purpose of being with God forever. And if we will not learn to live with a single person in this intimate fellowship, how in the world are we prepared to live in heaven with intimate fellowship with all kinds of people, including God Himself and His Spirit and His Son? We're just not prepared. Which is another way of saying we just won't be there. Because God does not allow unprepared people into His dwelling place. Marriage also teaches us a selfless devotion to another person, which is exactly what is required in our relationship with Christ. 1 Corinthians 6:19 says, "Or do you not know that you are not your own?" And he's speaking that of your relationship with Christ. You don't belong to yourself. But there's a similar thing going on with marriage. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3 and 4. Listen to what Paul says. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife. Likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, this might come as shock to some, also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. There is mutual respect and mutual union, if you will, here. One does not dominate over the other in this context here. But there's selfless devotion. Now, I understand that the context Paul is talking about here is sexual relationships in marriage, but the principle applies universally. He's talking here, in essence, about self-denial. You need to deny yourself in order to give yourself over to your wife. Wives, deny yourself in order to give yourself over to your husbands. Why? Because you both have denied yourself and have given yourself over to the Lord, and He wants you to practice that here, in the here and now, on a physical level. That's what He wants. Marriage allows us to do that. Marriage brings out the best and the worst in us, doesn't it? I think this comes from Red Skelton. I know I'm dating myself, if you even know who he is. I think it was Red Skelton that once said, "All men make mistakes, but married men find out about theirs a lot sooner." Marriage does bring out the best and the worst in all of us. It shows us our strengths. It also shows us our weaknesses. It reveals us as we really are. It's hard to hide from your wife or husband for very long who you really are. Anyone can behave themselves and put on a good show for the duration of a date or an evening out together. But do that over years and decades, you're going to get found out. Who you really are is going to get found out. And that marriage relationship is going to be the context in which you are going to be found out. Ideally, God uses this context of marriage to reveal our true nature to someone else, not for the purpose of embarrassing us or shaming us, but really so that we can become better people, so that those faults will be revealed and exposed, and then we can start working on those to become better people. That's what it's all about. And to serve as lights to the world and salt to the earth. To be better servants to God. These are some of the higher, nobler objectives of marriage. Man was not made for marriage. Marriage was made for man. It is a divine gift given for good reason. God did not give us marriage so that we had something to argue over, or so that we would inspire doctrinal debates over who's right and who's wrong, and to give legal, precise, technical, complex, forensic definitions to what marriage is, or to enslave people, or to burden them with something that really is of no fault of their own, or to oppress those who are in truly hopeless situations. He gave us marriage so that we could learn of Him and prepare for the heavenly relationships to come. This is a proper vehicle then for us to become better humans. But someone says, and someone will always say in lessons like this, maybe not to me, but in their heart, they're going to say, "Yeah, well, my marriage isn't all that great." But you realize that you don't need to have an ideal marriage to learn the lessons. Even a less than ideal marriage can teach. First of all, it is people who fall short of the plan. It's not the plan itself that is at fault. It's not marriage that's the problem. It's people not doing what they're supposed to do in marriage that becomes the problem. The second lesson means, or teaches rather, that we need to depend upon Jesus Christ because there's more going on here than we can bear on our own. To be successful anyway. The third lesson could be that earthly imperfections, whether they're mine or my spouse's or both of ours, magnifies the perfection of heaven. As we realize that this world really isn't the end of our existence, but that we were made for something greater than this, as we go through this life, that final existence becomes sweeter and more appreciated as we get nearer to it. This lesson is not meant to be soft on divorce, as you will find out in next week's morning lesson. But the fact is, if people want to divorce, they're going to find a way to do it. If Christians want to divorce, they will find a way to do it. All the lecturing and sermonizing and counseling and coaching is not going to stop that. In the end, people are going to do what they want to do. And I am convinced of this. There are some Christians who are defiant, who are selfish, and who are unwilling to listen, and therefore unable to learn with regard to marriage. I am confident of that. I have seen it for the last 30 some odd years. On the other hand, others will honor God by treating His gift of marriage with great respect. And they will embrace that plan, and through that plan, they will learn best how to implement that plan to its fullest potential, and they will learn how to live with their spouse in a Christ-like manner. The question I leave you with this morning is, whether you're married or planning on getting married, is what kind of person are you? Which one are you? Are you the one that's going to just be in it for yourself, and if someone doesn't do it your way, then you're done with them? Are you going to be the one that's belligerent, resistant, and stiff-arming God and say, I know you said that, but I'm going to do this anyway? Or are you going to be the one that gives yourself over to what God has said, gives yourself over to your wife or your husband, really embraces, as I said, this whole concept, this gift that God has given to you, and use it for good, to honor God? Which person are you? That's our lesson this morning. If you're subject to our invitation, we offer the gospel call on every lesson simply for the very purpose of giving people an opportunity to respond to that call if they need to. If you're ready to be baptized into Christ, because that's what you need to do if you're not a Christian and you are prepared for that responsibility, then we can help you with that. If you have other spiritual needs, we can pray for you. We want to see you do well. We want to see you glorify God with your life. If you need to come forward for those reasons, do so as we stand and sing the song that Bob has selected for us.